How many of you have ever done a trust fall before? A trust fall. Some of you may have done it even on the challenge course here. I'm no logician, but it seems to me that there are four elements at a bare minimum that are required for a trust fall. There is a person who must fall. There is a height from which to fall. There's a group of people that catch the person who falls. And then there's a fourth element, that somewhat intangible element known as trust, that has to be present. I don't know how many of you have ever been in a trust fall where the first person up there did not want to fall, right? Because here you have the person, you have the height, you have the group, but there's no trust there because they haven't had the chance to see someone else fall, because someone has to be first to fall. Let me tell you about, I mentioned in some message that I was working at a camp in Northern California. And there was an element in our challenge course that is what I would call a trust fall on steroids. It was called the 747. And the 747 was a telephone pole that was planted into the ground with wooden blocks on it. And the objective was to climb up the wooden blocks 40 feet up a telephone pole. And at the top of the telephone pole was a platform that was somewhat smaller than this space here, this music stand. And somehow you were supposed to hoist yourself from this vertical climb up wooden blocks onto a little one-by-one platform with your knees first. Then you get both knees up there, and then you get your feet under you somehow, and you stand up 40 feet up in the air. And it's waving. I don't know if you've ever been up that high on that thin of a thing, but it just sways with the wind. And if there's no wind, it's your knees knocking and it sways up there. Now, the objective of climbing to the top of this 40-foot platform, this 40-foot pole with a platform on the top, was to leap out 7 feet up and 7 feet out to catch a trapeze suspended from a wire. Just flying through the air with the greatest of ease. There's the foolish young man on the hanging trapeze. And I cannot tell you how many times I've done this element, and I felt the same way. I cannot tell you how many times people climb to the top of this thing and manage somehow to stand themselves up on that platform. Almost invariably, the first question was, "Have you got me?" Because you see, they're on belay. They're on a rope that's, you know, going through a wire. And then there's me down below, and I'm holding on to the other end of the rope in a harness tied to an anchor point so that when they jump, I've got them. And if they miss, I've got them. And I would say, "I've got you. Don't worry, you know. Don't worry. If you miss, I've got you. You know, you've seen this happen before. Are you sure you've got me?" "Yes, I've got you. You know, you can do it. I think I'm going to die." And I'd say, "Do you know Jesus?" "No, I'm just kidding. I would never say that." That would be awful. There's one of those times where you have all of the right things in place. The 40-foot pole, the climber, the trapeze, even the rope. And even the guy down on the bottom, but there's that intangible element that has got to be present. That this person has got to trust me down on the ground. That I'm paying attention and that I'm able to catch them if they fall. Now, the irony of it all was when someone was standing up there, there was literally, it would have been almost a physical impossibility to climb back down this pole, to get yourself from a standing position back down. And so people would want to, you know, some guys would get up there and they'd say, "I know I can make it. I know I can make it." And I'd say, "I know you can make it too. I believe in you. Just jump." They'd say, "What happens after I jump?" "Well, you're going to have to drop." Because that was the only way down. If you jump and you miss, you have to trust me. If you jump and you make it, you have to trust me. The trapeze doesn't go anywhere. It just hangs there. So you grab on, and after you grab on, you have to let go. So somewhere along the way, you have to trust me. You can try to climb down and fall. You can jump and fall, or you can jump and make it and then fall. But you have to trust me. How many of you feel like in life you are standing on the top of your own platform, and it may be 40 feet in the air, it may just be 4 feet off the ground, but it's something like a trust fall or a leap of faith where you know you've got to do something. Maybe you feel like you can back out or you can trust. Now, in your case, in all of our cases, it's not that we place our trust in a group of people with their arms spread out, or that we trust a belay guy down at the bottom with a harness and a rope, but that we have to trust the Lord. And we feel like at times we are going to die. How in the world do we respond to a situation like that? The message tonight will be from Mark chapter 11, verses 12 to 33. How in the world could I move a mountain? Mark chapter 11, verses 12 to 33, and I am going to skip one section in there. I honestly wish that we could spend the whole time in the whole chapter. It's incredible. I think in some ways the chapter itself answers the question, how can I change the world? I want to take just a piece of the answer to that question in the section before us today and ask, how can I move a mountain? Maybe you know the short answer to that, but I want us to look at it maybe in a bit greater depth tonight. Verse 12, on the following day, this is after Jesus has entered Jerusalem and visited the temple and then returned to Bethany for the night. When they came from Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Verse 13, and seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard it. Skip with me down to verse 20. And they passed by in the morning, that is the next morning. And as they passed by the next morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to Jesus, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. And Jesus answered them, have faith in God. Truly, I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also, who is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. The object of our faith. See, the scenario is that Jesus has gone to Jerusalem and he's come into Jerusalem really for the last time. As he passes by from Bethany to Jerusalem one morning, he sees a fig tree that is bearing no figs and he's hungry and he speaks a curse on it and says, may no one ever eat figs from you again. And the next day as they pass by, the tree is withered away to its roots, which cannot happen naturally so far as I know. That was a miracle that Jesus had done. I mean, all of you, my wife even said this one time, all of you have sprayed Roundup on your things, you know, a poison to kill a weed or a plant, and it takes days or weeks for it to work. And here, Peter is observant enough to see not only that the fig tree is withered, but to observe the fact that Jesus had cursed it the day before in their hearing. And it's like, you know, he had one of those touch lamp experiences. I don't know if you know what I mean, but those touch lamps, you know, you remember the first time you touched it and it worked? And you go, wow, it worked. And that's kind of how Peter responds. He went, whoa, Jesus, you know, Rabbi, you cursed this thing and now it's dead. And Jesus, his response to them is to say, have faith in God. Now, we have faith. Every person on earth exercises faith daily. But oftentimes, we express faith in our dilemma, in the problems that lie before us, whether they are financial issues, whether they are relational, family issues, or health, sickness kinds of things. All of us experience many problems that very often face us squarely, and we have a tendency to place a great deal of faith in them. They are simply too big. We know that this time it is just too much. At least that would be our initial reaction. This one, it's like Luke Skywalker in the swamp. I can do this since Harry was Darth Vader earlier on. It's like Luke Skywalker. Do you remember that when he crashes his plane into the swamp? And then he's supposed to be raising the plane up out of the swamp using his fingers. You know what I mean? And so he's doing this and Yoda is teaching him, you know, think not, you know, whatever. And so he's trying to raise the plane up and he gets the plane up. And then finally he looks at it and he goes, oh, it's just too big. And it sinks back into the, you know, into the swamp. And Yoda says something like, too big it is not, you know, or whatever he says. I got to get away from the force. I'm not talking about just the mystical force here, but you get the idea that it's just, this is just too big for me to handle. I cannot do this. And we have faith in the dilemma, in the size, in the complexity of it. But Jesus, in giving his answer to these disciples, who note this thing that he's done. And by the way, someone asked me one time as I was talking about this, why did Jesus curse the fig tree? I'm not going to answer that question. I don't know the answer to that question. I have a few guesses as to the answer to that question. And if you're really curious, ask me later. All I know is that Jesus used that act in order to teach this lesson. Let me go ahead and make one more disclaimer too. This is a lesson that bothers me. I like to be able to teach from the scriptures things that I feel like I've got a good grasp on. And I want to go ahead and tell you before I even launch into this, I do not feel like I have a great grasp on this experientially. The truth of it, I can see as plain as the hand in front of my face. But in terms of my own experience of it and my obedience to what Jesus is saying. And so I just want to tell you that up front. These things, when I say we tend to have faith in the dilemma, I'm talking about me. And I trust that at least for some of you, these things would be true as well. But it's clear that as Jesus is teaching these guys, he moves from the fig tree, this small thing, and points to probably the hill on which Jerusalem sat. The mountain around them. And he moves from this small thing to the mountain. And he says, have faith in God. Not just this small thing could be done, but anyone who would say to this mountain, go and throw yourself into the sea. If he doesn't doubt in his heart, even that thing would be done. It's not the size of the mountain that matters. But we tend to have faith in the mountain. We tend to have faith in prayer. I don't know how many of you have been, you know, prone to say, oh, we need to pray a lot about this one. As though somehow the quantity of our prayer might secure the answer that we seek. Or that we sometimes feel intrinsically that we need to say the right words. As if only we could be persuasive enough with God. And sincere enough in what we say to God. That would somehow move God. By the sheer volume of what we say, kind of like we do when we send a congressman one of those chain emails. You know, if we get 10,000 people to write him, he'll respond. And you know, if I say this thing and I come before him 10,000 times, Jesus does teach that we should persevere in prayer. But it's not the volume of our prayer that he seeks. It's persevering faith in the one who answers the prayer. We tend to have faith in prayer. And we tend to have faith in faith. We tend to have faith in believing. One time we were at the park with our kids. We have three kids. They're 8, 6, and 4. And our 6-year-old and 4-year-old girls were up on the, there's a one park with a really big slide. It's enclosed also. And our 4-year-old, she was 3 at the time, was going to try to go down the big dark tunnel slide. And she was kind of scared. And Katie, my wife, is down at the bottom. And she hears our 6-year-old up top coaching Rachel saying, Rachel, if you just believe, you can do anything. And we got a real kick out of that. If you just believe, you can do anything. But you can't have faith in just believing. Believing can't be the object of believing. It has to be believing in something. There has to be an object to our faith. And the fact of the matter is, I say we tend to have faith in ourselves. We almost invariably have faith in ourselves Because that is the lesson that our culture teaches us. That if we will simply rely on us, if I will simply rely on the resources within me, I can do anything. Katie and I were just on a date and we were at Borders Bookstore. And there is this just plentiful supply of books that we now label self-help, which if there is an oxymoron today, that is it. That we can somehow, relying on me and my past experiences and my character and my capacity and all of these things, that I can stand at the top of the dark tunnel of whatever problem it is, and if I will simply screw up enough courage in myself, I can do anything. Faith must have an object. It can't simply be faith in faith. The object of our faith ought to be God. But that is what Jesus says as his disciples, Peter in particular, expresses amazement at the fact that Jesus had spoken and something had happened. Miraculous. Jesus' first response is, have faith in God, and not just for the small thing, but for the mountain. And whoever says to this mountain, go and throw yourself into the sea, it'll be done for him. And what I think Jesus is driving at is that we should not have faith in the size of the mountain and the enormity of it, but we should have faith in the maker of the mountain. Because surely he is greater than the thing that he has created. And there's nothing in creation. There is no problem so large that God is not sufficient. That is simply an adjective which you could never use of God. That he would be insufficient for anything that we face. We don't recognize that limitation about God. Or we would no longer be thinking about God. So you see it clearly in verse 22. Have faith in God. Verse 23. And it will be done for him. That's a passive tense. By whom? It will be done for him by God. And I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it. From whom? From God. Implicit throughout this teaching is not that prayer secures answers. In this, somehow there's merit in praying a lot or believing very sincerely. It is belief in God. It is a trust that God is somehow in control and sufficient for every problem that we face. That is what lies at back of this teaching. Not just I name whatever it is that I want and God is there at my beck and call to give it. But it's that there is faith and trust, relational trust, in the one who has made every mountain that I encounter. I even find it in that last verse. And whenever you stand praying, forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also, who is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. There is a relationship that undergirds these faith-filled prayers. A relationship which we must be cautious or careful to sustain in repentance and obedience. Believe it or not, anyone may ask anything. Anyone may ask anything out of heart-level trust that God will fulfill His promise. This is my attempt somewhat to summarize what Jesus is teaching here. That anyone may ask anything out of a heart-level trust that God will fulfill His promises. Matthew 7, 7 and 8. Some of you may be familiar with it, at least in broad outline. It says, ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks the door will be open. It doesn't get much simpler than that. Ask and you'll receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. For the very holy, righteous, and pious churchgoers who pray a lot, when they ask, they will receive. It doesn't actually say that. It just says, very straightforward, everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be open. Anyone may ask for anything. John 14, 13 and 14, Jesus said, and I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. It is so simple and straightforward. It would take an adult to miss this.